Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm and thanks for joining me for another episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast. My guest this time is British sailing journalist and broadcaster Matt Sheehan, who I spoke to from Auckland, New Zealand, where he's working as part of the TV production team at the 36th America's Cup. Matt has covered more America's Cups than he might care to mention, and so he knows all the protagonists, and he's pretty much a guru on all things America's Cup. So with the official racing at the Prada Cup scheduled to start in just a few days, who better than Matt to quiz about the current state of play amongst the teams in Auckland? Matt Sheehan, you're very welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast, where you're speaking to me from the heart of the America's Cup race village in Auckland, New Zealand. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks, Justin. Nice to catch up with you.
Well, nice to catch up with you too. And listen, I have to just get this out of the way straight away. To say that I'm jealous that you're there and I'm not is the world's greatest understatement. Got that out of the way now, so I feel better about saying it. But Matt, you're down there for a very specific reason. You're working with the organisers on the media side of the America's Cup, the 36th America's Cup. Tell us about that role, just to kick us off.
Yeah, so I'm down here as the news producer, as you say, for the organisation, for America's Cup TV. And briefly, my job is to, with a team, working with a team, pulling together the news packages, so what they call the VNR, so the component of parts, or the kit of parts, of video and interviews and stuff from day to day that we then send out to all the broadcasters around the world that they then create their news stories from. This time around, we're actually doing dedicated packages as well. I mean, partly because the world's moved on and news is broadcast in a different way, as we all know, online and on social media and the rest of it. And partly because, you know, the current global pandemic has meant that very, very few people have been able to get down here. And so we're making, we haven't got the same press corps that you'd normally expect around an America's Cup. And so we're creating sort of dedicated cut and paste type packages as well to make sure that websites around the world, TV outlets and people who don't necessarily know as much about what's going on or aren't actually here to see it are still informed and have a good picture of what's been going on a day-to-day basis. So that's pretty good.
And what is the interest from around the world? What sort of sense do you get from who's, you know, because we love this sport. This is what we do for a living. And people who are passionate about yacht racing love the America's Cup. But do you get a sense that outside of that, there's a take up for the cup this time around?
Very much so. Very much so. It's been really interesting. I mean, I've been at every America's Cup since 2002, which was down here, down in Auckland. And I was down here doing a similar role, actually, not for TV. And that's when I got completely hooked by it. And so it has been very interesting to see what the audiences have been. It is early days. We've only had the America's Cup World Series. That was 4 days of racing. Well, three, really, because the weather didn't turn up on the fourth day. But what's, I think, those of us that have come down from the Northern Hemisphere, I think one of the things that we were thinking about before we came down was, you know, how much interest will there be? Because whilst New Zealand's a beautiful place and the boats are amazing and blah, 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 it is, on the other side of the world, in a completely different time zone. And there isn't, because of the restrictions nowadays, they're not going to be the number of visitors. New Zealand's had its borders shut for pretty much all of last year. They're still shut now, unless you can get an exemption. And so I did wonder whether that would damage the interest. But when you look at the figures online, even just the online figures, which are obviously one of the best ways of gauging interest, it's phenomenal. Now, I know in my own freelance sort of work, I've seen numbers go through the roof, and there's definitely no lack of interest in this. And of course, a large part of it is driven by these extraordinary boats, and they really are. I know I don't know how many times I've used that adjective extraordinary, but they really are. I mean, it's just amazing to see them.
Well, we're going to get into all of that. The boats and the racing and everything. I want to pick your brains on everything that you've been witnessing down there. But before we go any further, just talk a little bit about life away from your job. You're down in New Zealand. It's probably the best place in the world to be in the in this current global pandemic. We had Glenn Ashby talk to us on a recent episode of the podcast, and he talked a bit about life down there, and he said it was about as close to the old normal as it as you could imagine right now. What's your experience been like?
That's, I think that's absolutely right. It is. And I think the first thing to say is that there is the locals here don't underestimate for one minute how, or one second even, how lucky they are. And they're forever talking about, you know, how grateful they are that they've managed to hold COVID back and being able to carry on as normal. They do consider themselves extremely lucky. So they don't take anything for granted at all. And it is, of course, paradise, frankly. And I sort of hesitate to say that because the one thing I really don't want to sound is smug, because I'm obviously delighted to be down here, first and foremost, because I wanted to be here to see the Cup. But also it is amazing to be sort of outside of the pandemic. But it's a beautiful place. And I anybody who knows me knows how much I constantly waffle on about how much I love Auckland and New Zealand, and it's just a great place to be. But it also does come with, I think, with a set of concerns for those of us who've left families at home, who are here on their own. And whilst we are living the dream down here, we're very, very aware that others are living the nightmare or continuing to live the nightmare. And that does, at the risk of sounding a bit precious or soppy, it does bring other pressures. You know, you do. I felt it over Christmas and New Year. It was lovely down here, but I was worried about friends and family back at home, and you know, that doesn't change. And it's funny how you get to talk to friends who are working down here who've come from similar positions back at home, and they will just quietly admit the same thing. You know, it's not easy, and I'm not trying to ham it up. That is how it feels. But there's not much we can do about that. There's a limit to what we can do. And one of the messages that has come across very strongly, certainly from friends and family back at home, is keep telling the story, because we like the distraction. And the good news is there's going to be plenty of distractions on that level from down here. That's for sure.
I think that's right. And I think we've seen it, both of us, with our own kind of freelance projects that we operate. The uptake in interest while the Vendée Globe has been going on and now the America's Cup, I think you can't ignore the fact that there are people in lockdown who are just hungry for any sort of positive news and some sporting competition. And as you say, something to distract them from what everybody's going through.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the atmosphere in Auckland you've talked about, let's zone in a little bit. The Race Village, which from all the TV pictures that I've seen, looks really, really nice. What's the atmosphere like in the Race Village? Because there is nothing like an America's Cup Race Village, is there?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's great. It's funny enough, I had my wife's goddaughter was down here. Actually, I was giving her a tour, her and her boyfriend, a little tour of the Viaduct Basin and what was going on. She doesn't sail. And actually, it's sort of in describing it and showing her around, it made me sort of appreciate what I probably take for granted when I go down there each day. And there is a real buzz down there. There's no question about that. It's full of people. It is, after all, the middle of summer. And it's been, apart from today when it's chucking it down with rain, it's been a beautiful summer so far. And everybody's out and wandering around. The slight difference is that, of course, there aren't many, if any, international visitors, because they're, as I've said, they're not allowed in. So it's odd in that respect, in that it's very much it's an international event, but it's got a local audience. But that's just a little detail. It is a great venue. Anybody who knows Auckland and New Zealand and has been here in the past will know how much this city has developed as a direct result of the America's Cup, and also of Whitbreads and Volvos and other sailing events. But it's been the America's Cup that has provided the sort of financial catalyst to a lot of the development that's been going on since 2000. And it's extraordinary how the Viaduct Basin has opened up and just developed onto what was industrial land, wasteland. And it's turned it into one of the best sailing event venues that there is. I mean, it's full of bars and restaurants and walkways and things to see. And the Kiwis do it so well in that they have, you know, again, anybody who's been here before will know or seen the pictures will know that in a rather British way, they have a monument to one of their greatest failures stuck right in the middle of the Viaduct Basin, KZ1, the big America's Cup boat and the Dealer Gift match back in 1988. But they've got plenty of other exhibits as to, you know, why sailing is such a big deal down here. There's Steinlager in the Viaduct Basin. There's IACC, America's Cup class boats, the big heavy monohulls. There's one of those, I think it's only one that operates now, that does trips around the bay and has been doing it ever since I've been coming down here. And now they've got NZL60, the boat that the Kiwis successfully defended the America's Cup back in 2000. That's now sitting outside the team base. Their AC50 is hanging off the wall of the base. I mean, it's just all around you, and it's fantastic. And it's not – what's interesting, I find, is that you and I and others who follow some of the big races around the world, it used to go into a Volvo Ocean Race Village or something like that, where they're very impressive, but they're set up for a short period of time, and then I guess you call them pop-up. But they're set up for a short period of time, and then they're gone. That's not the case down here. This just goes on, and the story just keeps being added to. And what I love about it is that the story that they keep adding is irrespective of as to whether they win or lose. It's just, you can just feel the whole thing sort of growing. So it's a fantastic atmosphere, and it's one that's definitely not lost on the locals at all. I mean, they are wandering around, looking at the boats. There's a big simulator that you can go into. I haven't had a play on that yet, but I fully intend to. No, there's loads going on. And the other thing I'll say about the venue, which is interesting, which I find interesting when having been to quite a few of these now, is that the teams are relatively close together. So they're all with, if you stand sort of where Team New Zealand's base is, you can see all four of the team compounds. That might sound like a weird thing to say, but in San Francisco, you couldn't see them at all. I mean, they were on the other side of the harbor. They're just miles away. And you know, that's happened before as well. In San Diego, it was a similar thing. So it's really good to have these teams close. So you have got that sense of occasion. So it's a great place to be.
It really is. And the one thing I always appreciated about visiting Auckland with the Volvo Ocean Race was just how well-educated from a sailing point of view the New Zealand community is. When you just have to stand and earwig on some of the conversations as people are looking down at the boats on the pontoons and just a chat around bars. And these guys and you know, ladies and gentlemen, they know what they're talking about when it comes to yacht racing, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. There's no one in Auckland who doesn't have an opinion on the America's Cup, on some form of it. And that's always been the case down here, and it's even more so now. They're very well informed. They follow stuff closely, and of course that feeds the whole sense of occasion as well. So it's a great place to be.
Now, you mentioned the teams and the fact that you can see all of the team bases from each other. That sounds great, but what is the atmosphere like between all of those teams down there? I mean, you know, this is not a very kind of comradely type affair, isn't it? I mean, these are fierce to the death competitors for yacht racing's premier trophy.
It's certainly highly competitive. Obviously, this is, you know, arguably the world's most prestigious trophy in sailing. It's certainly the one where most money is spent. And there are a lot of secrets, and also we're in a period where all of the teams, including, you know, the architects of the Royal Team, Emirates Team New Zealand, are all on a very steep learning curve indeed, where performances are changing by the day. And not just changing by fractions of a knot, they're changing by huge leaps. And, you know, even in just 3 days of racing in America's Cup World Series, teams were openly admitting that they had learned a lot more about their boat than they'd expected, or that I'm thinking of American Magic in particular, actually, because Terry Hutchinson, the skipper of American Magic, was talking the other day about how they had expected to be to have problems in light weather, and yet they discovered that they actually weren't as slow as they thought. And, you know, these are teams of some of the world's best brains, not just the world's best sailors, but they got some of the best brains in the business behind the scenes from every aspect, from design to team management, shore base, you know, shore crews and everything else. And they're learning day by day. And so there's a lot to gain, but there's also a lot to lose if you let the cat out of the bag. So they are, understandably, rather tight-lipped at the moment, because even they don't know at times what secrets they may be giving away if they reveal something. So so they tend not to say anything at the moment. So there is a lot of competition between them. Having said that, one of the great things about the sport is that at the end of the day, they all have a common interest. And there is a coffee bar, with lots obviously down here, but there's one in particular just down on the front where in the morning, if you want to see evidence of how teams get on and catch up on a bit of gossip, just go and have breakfast down there, because everybody comes through there in the morning. And you'll find, you know, different teams talking to each other and chatting away. They're not swapping secrets. They're just, they've known each other for a long time. They're professional sailors, professional team members. And so there is a lot of chat. And I suspect in between it, sharing of ideas, maybe not the competitive side of it, but there is this sense, overriding sense, that this is a very, very exciting time for the sport, for the America's Cup. I know there's going to be plenty of people that will be jumping up and down disagreeing with me right now when I say it, but the fact of the matter is that these teams are discovering, even they're discovering, and they're the best educated, of course, they're discovering that there are huge leaps and bounds being taken in technology and the way they sail the boats, and they're discovering a completely new way of sailing. And yes, it was a couple of days ago, actually, but I was chatting to Ben Ainslie and some of the other crew members, and they were saying, and it wasn't even part of an interview, we were just chatting, and they were saying, these are incredible boats to sail. And I notice a difference in their tone now. About a year ago, when I was sort of talking to various people about them, there was sort of a sense that it's probably, these boats are great fun for couple of crew members who've either got hold of the wheel or they're trimming a sail or doing something like that. But if you're down in the pit grinding away, it's just a big grind fest producing hydraulic power, and where's the fun in that? And I think I sense now that that's changed, and that now, for whatever reason, sailing the boats, they're more connected now. And I suspect also that they've, over the hundreds, if not thousands of hours that they've been out testing, that they've all started to get their heads around what the boat feels like when it's right, when it's wrong, and they're coming back towards feeling like they're sailing a boat. Because at the moment, I am hard-pressed to find anybody, even a grinder with their head down facing the wrong way, that doesn't say that they're incredible machines to sail. And that's a bit of a change from 12 months ago.
Yeah, I read a really interesting piece by Freddie Carr, one of the grinders with the British team, who said, yeah, it would be easy to imagine that as a grinder, all you need to do is just lock in, look at your screen, and grind your heart out. He said, you know, you could imagine I could be watching Netflix. He said, but he took it back to the days of the displacement monohulls in the America's Cup. And he said, even when you were grinding then, you're constantly racing the boat. You're constantly thinking, how is everything going on the boat? Keeping an eye out for things going wrong, always ready to jump in and back somebody up. And he said, that was then. It's even harder to do that now. He said, but that's where we're trying to get to. That's the goal. So that, yes, we're grinding, and yes, we're developing all this power, but we're also very much racing the boats.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. In fact, funny enough, I spoke to him the other day as well, and he was saying, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but he was saying, you know, it's great after, I can't remember how many years he said, it was like 10 years or something. He said, I get to look out the side of the boat now. I've just spent the last 10 years looking out the back, because his grinding position has always been facing aft. So he's never known where the windward mark was. But he said, at least now I'm looking out the side, I get a much better view.
Good old Freddie, always good for a quote. Matt, tell me where you were for the ACWS Auckland event. Were you on the water? Were you in the race village? Where were you?
I had the best seat in the house, frankly. I was in, and will be for the rest of this event, in the TV gallery. So I'm in the place where the production takes, the live production takes place. That's the signal that gets, the feed that gets sent out to all the broadcasters who are rights holders. And so I'm sitting in there where we have umpteen screens, walls of screens with every camera angle that is available, all the commentary, commentary and also all the audio feeds from the crews as well. So there could not be a better place to be if you want to see what's going on. It's also rather disorientating, I have to say, but it's, I love it. It's really exciting. It's, there's a real buzz in there. You're right in the heart of it. And, but it's disorientating in a way in that there are so many feeds, so many things coming up back from onboard cameras, from the helicopters, from the chase boats on the water, the audio feeds, that sometimes it's hard to know what to watch and you can just get overwhelmed by it. But it's a fascinating, exhilarating place to be. I absolutely love being in there. I do also love being on the water. And yet I have to say, I haven't been on the water yet. I'm hoping to go out actually to join a team for some, to go and watch some training, hopefully over the next few days. Fingers crossed that'll happen. But I mean, there is nothing quite like being on the water as well. And I'm really excited about going out and seeing these boats for real. But the thing is nowadays is that having commentated and written, I've written reports on every single America's Cup race since October 2002, and also the cup things that weren't part of the cup racing, most of that commentary has been done from a position of either from a media boat or a rib or been on the water. And then, but as the boats have got faster and the racing has got faster and faster, and since we've had the what was then called Liveline, the company that developed the aerial views where you've got the grid work of the course painted, overlaid onto the TV pictures. When we got to that stage, it became harder and harder as a commentator, as a journalist, as an observer, to really compete with that when you were trying to describe what was going on the water. The days of being able to sort of compare the heights of masts as they were going up the beat to be able to assess which boat was in the lead when they're a mile and a half away from you, they're sort of gone now. You can't use that. I mean, you sort of can. I'm sure that the teams who spend hundreds, if not thousands of hours out in the water watching this, they'll be able to do it, but they're just about the only people that can. So the place to be to really get your head around what's been going on and to be able to tell a good story, which I hope we do, is in the gallery. So that's where I've been and that's where I will be.
Sounds like the perfect place for you to be. I can't imagine a wider grin on anybody's face than on yours when they showed you to your chair.
Oh, yeah. No, it's very nice. I have my own desk as well, which is an absolute luxury in the gallery. Anybody who's been in one will know that it's very similar to rush hour commuting on the tube in London, in that there's absolutely no space. You're pressed up against people and it's squashed in this room. But actually, this one is a lovely gallery. It's really good.
Well, a shout out to the commentary team, Kenny Reid, Nathan Outridge, and of course Shirley Robertson out on the water. I listened, of course, to the whole of the AC World Series. I thought they did a great job. I thought the relationship between Nathan and Kenny is developing really quickly and really nicely. A good foil for each other, and of course Shirley's experience out on the water is always appreciated. I think they're doing a great job.
No, they are. It's a good team to work with, and we're all working out of the same production office as well. So our morning meetings and catch-ups are really interesting because, as you've said, there's some very interesting views. Clearly, all three of them are hugely experienced sailors, and it's fascinating listening to their sort of comments and their observations. I can't think of a better team, really. I think it's really good.
So let's just take a little look at AC World Series Auckland. I think, first of all, the thing we've got to say is that we all, I think, possibly breathed a sigh of relief that the racing was good. It was generally pretty close, and it was at times extremely exciting. So the concept of these AC75s as good race boats, aside from being technological wonders, I think has been borne out, hasn't it?
It has, and I think that's one of the most interesting things about this cup cycle so far. We have only seen 4 to 3 days of racing, and we all know why that is. There was supposed to be an awful lot more, and obviously world events have knocked that on the head. But above that, there was this concern that this is, of course, this is a brand new design. It's not just a new America's Cup design. It's an unprecedented concept. When we've seen new design rules come into the Cup in recent years, in the last 20-odd years, they've been relatively, you could argue, they've been relatively, by comparison, straightforward. When we moved from 12 meters to the International America's Cup class, the IACC boats, it was still a monohull. It was a monohull that was longer, lighter, deeper keel, bigger kite, but it was still a monohull. I mean, actually, I was just looking back the other day, actually, they had spinnaker poles. Remember them? They had spinnaker poles and symmetric kites and the rest of it. And but they were an evolution of a concept that we knew very well. When it then moved across, I know, we had in between, we had the Dida Gift match between the giant 130-foot trimaran of Oracle and the slightly smaller cat of a Lingi in the Dida Gift match. And they were amazing machines. And you could argue that actually that Oracle with its wing mast was the thing that really started to change the You could argue that Oracle was the catalyst for wing sails, certainly in the America's Cup. But even then, it was a multi-hull, and wing masts as a concept, maybe not that big, have been around for a long time. So there wasn't, again, it wasn't a big change. And even when we ended up with the AC-72 class, which obviously came through the AC-45s, the 45-foot wing-masted cats that weren't on foils at that stage, they were just, in inverted commas, cats with solid wing sails. We'd seen both before, but maybe not in as many numbers and certainly not in a big size, a 45-foot package. Obviously, the Kiwis put them on foils. That took the world by surprise. And since then, they've been leading the foiling agenda, and it's been an extraordinary ride and an extraordinary period of development, not just with the foils, but with the control systems and the learning that has gone on around it. And sometimes that's, I believe, actually, that whilst the boats look incredible, the amount of development that's happened behind the scenes that we've yet to really feel as in the rest of the sport is massive. But anyway, that's probably a whole different subject. But again, getting back to my point is that, they're multi-hulls. We've seen multi-hulls before. We've seen fours before. We've seen solid wings before. And when we saw the 72-foot cats in San Francisco in 2013, they were just amazing beasts. They were just incredible. But again, still multi-hulls and still what we've seen. Go on to Bermuda, same thing again. This, no one's ever seen anything like this before. No one has ever seen a 75-foot monohull on one foil and a T-foil at the back. And it is a leap beyond anything that we've seen before. So the danger is that whenever a new class comes in into play, that actually none of the teams even know which corner of the rule, if you consider the sort of options that you might have as a box, the designers often call it a design box. No one really knows who's going to hang out in which corner and how different those boats are going to be. And the danger is, because they've never seen anything like it before. So the danger is that when you get on the race course, you get a bunch of very different looking boats that are fascinating for a geek like me who wants to talk about various design aspects and blah, blah, blah. But actually, they're so wildly different in performance that it comes at the cost of decent close racing. And I felt that, and I don't mind admitting it, I felt that there was a very strong case that in this incident that we wouldn't be seeing close racing, and that there would also be a high level of breakdowns, and it was going to be, the danger was that it was going to end up a bit like San Francisco, where there were going to be lots of one horse races and where boats couldn't get around the course. And of course, we did see a bit of that in the America's Cup World Series, but we also saw tacking duels. We saw boats covering other boats. We saw that they're not afraid to go head to head at closing speeds of 60 knots and more in the pre-start, and put three penalties, you know, or three penalties to be delivered in the pre-start, in the 2 minutes before they got going. I mean, there was plenty of close action there. And we only saw 3 days of racing, and that was the opening 3 days. And what makes it even more staggering, I think, is that it's easy to take, you know, you watch these boats for a while, and then we all start to get used to seeing boats doing 42 knots upwind in 12 knots of breeze, and have to keep pinching ourselves at, you know, what we're actually watching. But it's also easy to underestimate how much nerve you have confidence in something that you're still learning, that, you know, they don't know. There's still a lot these teams don't know about how their boats handle, and to take it into battle and go head to head and do close quarter maneuvers and put penalties on others and tack underneath them and cover them and slip inside them at windward marks and sail as closely as they do takes a huge amount of nerve, frankly, as far as I can see. But it's great for the rest of us because we get to see some extraordinary racing. And this is before they've even really got their heads around lots of close racing. Because remember, teams have not been allowed all through this development, in order to keep the cost down, development, teams weren't allowed to do any two-boat testing. So they weren't allowed to race against their own, even though they had two boats. They couldn't do any two-boat testing. Not that they could probably do it logistically anyway, but they couldn't do it. They were banned from doing it. They were banned from racing against each other and pairing up against each other until just before the beginning of the America's Cup World Series. So to see them go head-to-head in that way, in these extraordinary machines where they have no idea how they're going to handle, really, I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration because they have got simulators and the rest of it. But even so, you don't know that, you know, when you're stuffing the boat into a corner at 35 knots or whatever it is, if the foil's let go, you don't know what's going to happen next. So it's, there's some bold manoeuvres going on. But anyway, the bottom line is that the racing was way better. The spectacle, I should say, was way better than many of us expected. And, you know, I'm delighted that I'm currently eating my hat. Well, I never said I would eat my hat, but you know what I mean.
I do. No, and I think it's a fair point. And I think it was reasonable of you to be nervous about it, because I think everybody was. So lots must have been going on in the debriefs after. Well, the debriefs would have started on the first day of racing, I'm sure. But they were sucking in data. They got the chance to race against the other teams and get some appreciation of where they are in the pecking order. And just leaving the Brits out of it for obvious reasons for a second, the pecking order between the Kiwis, the Americans and the Italians, how do you see it? Just kind of quickly on each one, how do you see they came out of that regatta?
I think the Italians look like they have, they were the strongest in the light weather. They seem to have got their head around, and they actually admitted that. That's how they felt. They felt that they went into it thinking we're probably going to be quite good in the light. We're a little bit nervous about our performance in the stronger breeze. As it turned out, the event was a mainly light weather event, and they were pretty slippery. They were also really interesting because they've got this dual pilot system. You know, they've got Francesco Bruni on one side and Jimmy Spittle on the other, and they don't swap from side to side. And I think we haven't yet seen, I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch in the future, because I think we haven't quite yet seen the full benefit of that yet. So that's very interesting. At the moment, we haven't seen much of them in testing over the last few days. Their boat's been in the shed. They have made a few little alterations, I'm told, mainly to do with aerodynamics and fairings around the crew. But they were good in that respect. The American Magic went into the America's Cup World Series thinking that they had a potential weakness in the light, but were confident about their stronger wind performance, and certainly of the early video footage that I saw of them, they looked very confident indeed in chucking the boat around in a breeze, particularly upwind. Strangely, their tacks are unbelievable. They came out of the America's Cup World Series thinking, crikey, actually, we're better than we thought in the light. So, but they're under no illusion that they've still got a fair way to go. They were, of course, the only challenger to beat the defenders, Emirates Team New Zealand. And if you count one of the practice races, they beat them twice. And if they hadn't have tripped up in one of the races, they would have beaten three times. So they were, I think, overall, if you had to pick top challenger, which is only three, so it's not that hard, they come out of it as, they came out of the America's Cup World Series as top challenger. And then it leaves the defenders, Emirates Team New Zealand. They are the favourites, in my mind. They are the clear favourites at the moment. That doesn't mean that they are immune from tripping up. These boats are fragile, complex boats. It won't take, everybody knows, everybody in the team knows, it really doesn't take much of a breakdown to ruin your day. That's partly the nature of these beasts. So they're not immune from it at all. But if you take that out of the equation and just look at the state of the development of their boat, they are, in my opinion anyway, a long way ahead of anybody else. And whilst the focus has been on the hulls and the foils and maybe where the, how the crew, you know, operates, to me, the big focus at the moment, the thing that's has drawn my attention a lot, is in the rigs. And the rigs and the sail plans hasn't been really discussed that much. But what the World Series showed us was some fascinating shots from the back of the boat looking forwards. And the thing that comes across, two things come out of that, as far as Emirates Team New Zealand are concerned. One is how sophisticated and complex their main seems to be, with the hydraulic ram for the sheet for starters, but a whole bunch of other hydraulic rams that we believe control camber adjustments up the sail. And there's all kinds of discussion and chatter going on about how they do that and whether actually some of it might even be automated. I hesitate to say that, but because it has other connotations, but the way in which they can change the sail shape through a tack, through a jibe, and control the shape of the sail in the way that you might change the way that you sort of accelerate, you know, when you're driving a car, racing around a track or something, or when you're sailing when you're racing a boat in light weather and you go through a tack and you don't sheet the jib on straight away, but you gradually wind it on. That all sounds quite basic stuff, but it's the same principle, but in a much more complex way. And what's so telling on the Kiwi boat is that when you look from the back, looking forwards on that onboard camera, and you compare it to the Challengers, the clue of that main is hardly moving at all. You watch it the next time you see them. We won't see them racing, of course, so you'll have to go back and look at the America's Cup World Series footage. But look at how little the Kiwi main moves through a maneuver compared to the amount that it moves on the Challenger boats. And I think that this is to do with the way in which they can control their power. And they control the power in the main, not by dumping the main down the traveller, as you might expect, and as the challengers seem to do. They control their power through the twist of the main. Now, we can't see that because there isn't a camera looking up the leech, but there are helicopters looking down, and so there is some footage there that shows how they change the shape of the sail. But it's fascinating, and I think, you know, there are lots of areas where the Kiwis are, I think, ahead, and it's hardly surprising. They've led the foiling agenda for many years now, and they have been the architects of this rule as well. And that's how the America's Cup worked. You win the cup, you make the rules. So and they're enjoying the benefits of that, and they're doing it extremely well.
That's mainly focused around the technology, the boats, the rigs, the sails. From a human point of view, we've got some quite different characters in charge of these boats and in key roles on the boats. Who were the standout performers for you across those three teams?
That's a much harder question to answer, actually, because for several reasons, and it's going to sound like I'm hedging, but I'll be honest, I would say that there's really not much separating them. I mean, we are talking about three Challengers, one Defender. So we're talking about a small group of boats and some of the world's best sailors. And there is so little to separate them at the moment. It's partly because the pressure hasn't really come on yet. I think we'll start to see the differences when the pressure comes on and it gets real with the prospect of being knocked out and going home. And the pressure will come on even more when we get close to the cup. But at the moment, there's little to separate them. They're all still very jolly and get on reasonably well at press conferences. There was a little bit of needle in some of the press conferences, in particular when things were going wrong on the control systems, for the Brits anyway. And there was a bit of needle going on there. But I mean, they've all got their different, they sail in different ways, they have different characteristics, but at the moment, they're still pretty even. There's very little to separate them.
The Kiwis were criticised a little bit for the pre-start stuff, where there was, you know, I did hear some chatter that, you know, perhaps Pete wasn't engaging properly or he'd made mistakes in the pre-start. Do you think that's valid, or was he just really not that interested in engaging at that point?
No, I think that's very valid. And I think that is a good point you raise, actually. That was one of the few, well, there were a number of incidents, if we're looking at Emirates Team New Zealand, a number of incidents that showed that they're not invincible and that they do have weak points. I mean, I'm sure they'd be the first to admit it as well, maybe not publicly, but amongst themselves. In the pre-start that you're referring to, they got pushed by, it was by Jimmy Spitter, wasn't it? It's by Luna Rossa. They got pushed in the pre-start out to the left-hand end of the start line into what is commonly known in match racing terms as coffin corner. Because once you get pushed down to that left-hand end of the line, the pin end of the line, if you're the leeward boat, the only way, well, it doesn't matter whether you're a leeward boat or not, actually, but if you're at that left-hand end of the line, the only way back to the start line is on port tack once you get past a, you know, a certain point. And of course, as we know, port tack, you've got to give way. And it's a classic, basic, fundamental principle of match racing is that you don't get yourself stuck in coffin corner. And they got pushed straight into coffin corner and had to delay their tack coming back and coming back out. Now, you could argue that if they think that their performance, their boat is so much quicker, which arguably you could say it is, then, okay, well, we're prepared to take, you know, take the hit there because we'll just stick the foot down and get past them. But that's not how these people think. These are competitive sailors. They don't, that would have hurt. And that would have been interesting in the debrief. I'm sure Peter Berling would have felt, and it's not totally down to him, he's driving the boat, but he's not calling the tactics. I think they would have felt that. And I think they would have felt a bit, you're lucky in, well, I mean, they nearly destroyed their foil on the windward mark when they came into the top mark at 40 knots. And just a miscommunication, for whatever reason, Pete Berling wasn't listening to Glenn Ashby, who was calling him into that mark. And Glenn Ashby's getting more and more agitated about him putting the bow down. And they so nearly hit it. I mean, if they'd hit that mark at 40 knots, those marks are I'm told they're 900 kilos. They're not inflatable marks. They're solid fiberglass marks with a lot of kit inside them. You hit that, that would have ripped the, well, it doesn't bear thinking about what it would have done. But, you know, it's another illustration that actually they do have weak points. They do have their issues at times like anybody else.
Now, weak points and issues, that's a cue for the British team after that performance in the AC World Series. I don't want to go through it again, but, you know, partly because it's so painful for us as Brits to talk about that. But I'm interested in what you've heard now about the way the team has rallied round. I'll full disclosure, I had a conversation with Ben on email for a little article I'm putting together for the Yacht Racing Life website, and he sounded quite bullish in that. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, much the same. I've been talking to the team. I met the team. I was in the team base the other day doing some interviews over there. I hesitate because there are some people who think, oh, well, you know, you're a Brit, you're down there, you're reporting on it, you want to stay in with them, you're never going to tell us, you know, what the real mood is in there. And if those people think like that, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to convince them otherwise. The atmosphere in the team is very good overall. You may or may not believe that, but it is. And I think there's a good reason, well, there's two very good reasons why they are very positive at the moment. That is one, because they're all professionals and many of them have been in similar positions to this before. And so they have the experience and they know that there are two ways of dealing with this. You can either melt down, and I know there are some commentators on the outside who are suggesting that the team is in free fall and they're at each other's throats and they're, you know, they're just in complete disarray. That is complete nonsense. They are not. They may have been caught on the hop. They know full well that their performance, and they freely admit their performance was not what they wanted and rather embarrassing. And they just, but there are two ways to deal with it. You can either go into meltdown or you can look at the time you've got and say, well, this is the time, the race starts here now for us. This is the time we've got available to turn things around. If we're going to, I mean, they don't say this, but this is me putting words on it, but you know, if they are going to have a punch up, the time to have a punch up is when they've passed the point of no return. They know that. They're professionals. And so they're focused on doing whatever they can do to turn it around. And hopefully, from their point of view, obviously, hopefully they can. But so there's a very, and you get that sense within the team compound. You get that sense with them. They know that they've got a big, big mountain to climb, but they're determined to do it. And the next few weeks is going to illustrate whether they've managed to do it or not.
So not long for them before the start of the Prada Cup, and they have to declare, I think, their boat on the Wednesday. Is it the 13th or the 12th? I can't just recall. That's a pretty key moment for all the teams, isn't it? That declaration day. Just talk about that a little bit, Matt.
Yes, it is. Well, there are various measurement days and declaration days, but and I don't have the rule in front of me, and I'm not that well briefed. I don't quite know exactly what the rules are on this, but they can change as they go. Basically, they can change and modify their boat as they go through certain stages, and I can't remember where the change periods are. So it is important next week when the boats are measured and they have to declare what foils they're using and a whole number of other things. But it's not the end of the road. That's not their final decision. There are other points at which they can change. I just can't remember exactly where they are. But, yeah, it's important to get it right. Obviously, weather's going to be a big part of that as well, picking the right kit for kind of weather they're expecting. But it might be quite hard for us actually to identify as well what they've done. I mean, these boats are quite tricky to figure out. Unless it's a physical change to the boat, we've just seen that with American Magic. They've increased the size of their bustle or skeg, depending on what you call it, but basically the blade that runs down from the bow down towards the stern on the center line, they've increased the size of that. It's significantly bigger. So we can see that, but it's difficult to spot other things.
And of course, it's difficult to know, isn't it, whether these were scheduled improvements or reactions to what they learnt in the AC World Series, and I guess we probably won't know those things until after the whole event is done and dusted.
No, probably not. But I suspect that what's happened, I mean, time is always an issue. You hear it again and again and again. And so I think it's unlikely that there's much time available to do quick knee-jerk changes. You know, if you've suddenly seen something, oh yeah, crikey, that looks good on the other boat, I think well let's do that. I don't think it really works like that. It takes these components, I mean, particularly if they're things like foils or structural components, they take a long time to make. You don't make those, you don't knock those up overnight out of a bit of angle iron or something. These are complex composite products, and they take a long time to make. So it takes, you can't really implement something that quickly. But I think what's more likely is that during the over the period of the design and the evolution of their boats, they will have looked at all kinds of different options and they would have implemented a number of them. And then they'll be looking at back at the racing they've done. They'll be looking at what their competitors are doing now to a certain degree. and seeing whether what they've learned fits into any of supports, any of the other options that they thought of along the way. That's not to say they're not developing new ideas, but I think they've got a suite of things that they can choose from. And I just get the feeling that that's what it's about, a large part of what it's about. It's about identifying where, you know, if you think of your performance as sort of being, I don't know, you know, from left to right and it's a linear scale, where were we? We thought we were two-thirds down to the left, say. Were we there, or did we actually end up a bit further up this way? And how do we get to where we want to be? It's sort of, they know sort of the rough boundaries of it. It's just figuring out how the best way to get there.
Yeah, it's it's fascinating to watch it play out. We're kind of a little obscured, or quite a lot obscured, as to what the teams are doing exactly. But I think this Prada Cup is going to be fascinating to watch. I'm expecting the teams to be a little bit different to what we saw in the AC World Series. But how do you see it playing out, Matt?
I think the interesting thing about the Prada Cup is that actually we're going to see sort of the fleet reset, if you like. You know, we had 3 days of racing before Christmas. They've gone away, learned some lessons, decided what they'll do or don't want to do. And they were saying way out that by the time we get to the next set of racing, you're going to see very different boats, sort of metaphorically, because actually it's quite, the boats themselves will, to us, look much the same as they did before until you start drilling down into the detail. And those are only the bits you can see. You know, it's easy to forget or overlook, let's say, that that these are really complicated boats inside, and the systems that allow the boats to fly and to be controlled are very, very complex indeed. And, you know, they're a large part of what makes it all possible. And we're never going to see that. We're only ever going to find out about it if they can explain it to us. And even if they were willing to, I suspect we wouldn't understand half of it, because it's, you know, it's like explaining the inner workings of a Formula One race car. You know, it really is that complex. So the boats are going to be different. I think be prepared to see some rather different performances. I think my gut feeling, like, along with several other people down here, is that the Brits are going to be significantly better than they were before. I think we're going to see them win some races. Whether it's enough to get them back up on top of the curve and back up on an even basis with their two challengers, well, we don't know. We will just have to wait and see. But we're going to see some different performances. I think also we're going to start to see, this is where it starts to count, remember. America's Cup World Series, great to watch, great testing, blah, blah, blah. Didn't count for anything in terms of points. So that does change the way that it was really a sort of testing program, really, for the teams, rather public one. Now it starts to count. And so I think we will see more in the way of competitive behavior. I think we're going to see more boat-on-boat action. We're going to see more penalties. We're going to see more. We're going to see them going head-to-head a bit more in the pre-start. I'm delighted to see that there's pre-start action, because I really didn't expect there to be that. But that's pretty exciting. They were hampered a bit in the World Series because they had all kinds of other problems with timing and being able to see the ley lines, and there were some communication issues, and, you know, these are teething problems which will get ironed out. But it meant that some of the time they were sailing blind when they were coming into the start. And it's easy to criticize someone being 10 seconds late for coming in, but when you're doing 35, 40 knots and you've got to eyeball it and you don't even know where the wind, you know, you can't feel the wind or anything else, I mean, it was extraordinary, even managed it. But I think we're going to see the whole thing tightened up a lot. I think we'll see closer racing. Sure, we will inevitably see breakdowns, but I think we're in for quite a spectacle.
We are, for sure. And Matt, we can't finish our conversation without a shameless plug for your Planet Sail video series, which everybody has been enjoying. We've been running them on the Yacht Racing Life website, and it's been going down a storm. Just tell us about Planet Sail and what it's about, what you've created there.
Yeah, well, thanks. First of all, thanks for that, Justin, and thanks for helping to spread the word. I've been blown away by the rise in popularity in it. Delighted. It's basically, in a nutshell, it's a YouTube sailing channel, Planet Sail, and we cover all kinds of things in the racing world, from dinghy racing to round the world racing to America's Cup and all kinds of things. And at the moment, I'm doing running a mini series from down here, along with various other things that we're covering. And it's been very, very popular, I'm delighted to say. And one of the lovely things from, you know, as a from a journalist point of view, with my proper journalist hat on, is that in this modern digital world, and having been doing it for quite some, having been a journalist for quite some time now, one of the great things about the digital world is the feedback and the response that you get. Not so much in buffing up my ego, although I'm always open to a bit of that, but it's great to know what people like seeing and how they respond to it and whether they like it or loathe it or what they want to see more of. Or, and it's brilliant because it helps us to sort of really mold and shape the kind of features that we're doing. And I find that almost as exciting as the feature stuff itself. And this is a fantastic place to be doing it. One of the things that I absolutely love about the America's Cup, aside from all the technology and the geek fest that it is, one of the great things about the America's Cup that stands out over other aspects of racing is it's like Groundhog Day down here. You know, every day is, and it's the same routine, and you go out there and do it again, and then you go and watch it, see the racing, and then you come in and you go out and you do it all over again. An offshore race, someone like the Volvo, which I love, or the Ocean Race, or you know, some of those things which I also love covering, you don't get that opportunity to refine the way that you tell the stories and then refine what works, what doesn't. And that's what this is really, really good for. And that's why the America's Cup coverage, whatever it is, whether you're a written journalist, whether it's TV, whatever it is, whether you're standing up and presenting on a boat to a bunch of guests, people get more refined because they start to learn. We all learn more about it and get better at telling that story. And ultimately, that's what's good for, I believe, for sailing overall, is that if we can tell stories in an engaging way, because we all know that it's an exciting sport to watch, it's getting it across to people who don't necessarily understand it or don't have any experience of it, getting them to buy into it and see how exciting it is a thrill in itself. And that's definitely come across through the video stuff that I've been doing on Planet Sail, and it makes it really, really worthwhile. It's great fun to do.
Well, we're definitely on the same page when it comes to that, Matt, and the best of luck with that. The best of luck also with your role with the America's Cup. I'm now going to be able to imagine you at your desk in the production and the broadcast studio. You know, the best of luck to all the teams for this upcoming Prada Cup, particularly to Sir Ben and the Ineos guys, because I think all of us want to see three competitive challengers racing in this series. But for now, thanks a million for taking part. Your insight's been absolutely brilliant to have on the show. And we'll hopefully speak again very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Justin. And look forward to it.